ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming to the Lowy Institute. We're here tonight to take stock of the Trump presidency and what it means for Australia and the world. Now, I will introduce myself first. I'm James Curran, and I teach history at Sydney University, but I'm also a non-resident fellow here at the Lowy Institute. And of course, I'm delighted to be joined by the Lowy Institute's Executive Director, Michael Fullilove. And we're going to talk about Michael's article that he's just had published in Foreign Affairs, which I believe many of you have a copy of. And if you don't have one now, there'll be one for you on the way out. I might just make a few remarks at the beginning. We're now 7 months into Trump's term of office, and the White House, as I'm sure many of you would agree, remains a swirling cauldron of volatility, revolving doors, and chaotic dysfunction. One by one, some of the more controversial figures in this administration have either gone or fallen on their sword. Michael Flynn, Sean Spicer, Scaramucci, Reince Priebus, and most recently, Steve Bannon. The jury's still out on whether the new Chief of Staff, John Kelly, can steady the ship, but he's certainly made his presence felt. Now, United States allies who have already been unnerved by Trump's lurid prescriptions on the campaign trail have watched on at times with bemusement, at other times they've been aghast. But every moment where there's been an apparent settling or normalising of this administration and its style of governing, there's a Trump tweet. So even more reason, I think, now to try and, as I said, take stock and look at some of these tectonic forces that might be moving beneath the surface of these political events. What does it all mean? What can we say at the 7 month mark about what does this all mean for Australia and indeed the world? I think the big question for Australia and other close US allies has always been whether Trump is presiding over a period of US retrenchment, that is a pulling back from the Pax Americana, or whether this is one of those moments, as America has had in the past, where the providential impulse, that idea that America has a redemptive mission, is pushed to the background of its foreign policy. Now, Foreign Affairs magazine, which is the leading magazine on foreign policy in the United States and indeed around the Western world, has published a special issue, its latest issue. It's about to hit the bookstands, the newsstands, I should say, according to my news agent, Summerhill anyway, tomorrow, the special air freight edition. But it's published a special issue on what do the allies think of Trump, and that's where Michael's article appears. Now, Gideon Rose has said in his editorial, let me just read very briefly, this is introducing the issue, perhaps no group has been more flummoxed by the Trump era than US allies, who awoke last November to find Washington no longer interested in playing the game, let alone managing the team. Having spent more than half a century believing American responses, American promises of open-ended support and basing their identity and essential national policies on it, the major US allies couldn't easily return to a self-help system, even if they wanted to, which none of them do. Now, I think, broadly speaking, there have been four responses in Australia to the Trump era, very quickly. The first, alarmism, panic that we might be seeing US retrenchment from Asia or west of Hawaii. Secondly, the radical nationalist response, which takes the form, if you're Paul Keating, of cutting the tag. If you're Richard Di Natale, it's ending the alliance altogether. If you're Nick Xenophon, it's rethinking the alliance. Thirdly, pragmatic realism. That is, manage Trump, take him one step at a time, but lower your expectations of what can be achieved when he's in office. And largely, sentimentalism. That is, hold a swanky dinner aboard a floating museum in New York and talk about the diggers and mateship. And as I understand, there will even be a special Fulbright scholarship named in honour of mateship next year. That's an initiative of the Ambassador Joe Hockey. So the progressive pinching of this word mate from the New South Wales right of the ALP is now complete. Now, Michael, your Foreign Affairs article is a major contribution to this stocktake of the Trump presidency, what it means for this country. Just before I ask Michael the first question, I make the point it's not often that Australia gets onto the contents page of Foreign Affairs. I can tell you that in the last 60 years, that is roughly spanning the period from Harold Holt's declaration on the south lawn of the White House that he would be all the way with LBJ in Vietnam, to Malcolm Turnbull's comment a couple of weeks ago that Australia was joined at the hip with the United States. In the last 60 years, articles about Australia or its foreign policy or its alliance with the United States have appeared only six times in six decades, and only once in the last 40 years has there been an article like this one in the print edition of Foreign Affairs. Bates Gill and Tom Switzer had an article in the online edition in 2015 about the alliance, but not since 1977, when T.B. Miller wrote an article called From Whitlam to Fraser, has there been an article in Foreign Affairs. So I'll just make that point. The titles of these articles haven't been, from the 60s, haven't been exactly thrilling or inspirational. Australia and Southeast Asia, Paul Hasluck, 64. Australia and the Defence of Southeast Asia, Shane Paltridge, the former Minister for Defence, October 65. Australia Looks Around, by Donald Horne, in 1966. The ambiguity, because Australia was just starting to break out of its imperial chrysalis at the time. Anyway, Michael, what does this mean? Why has Australia not featured so prominently in foreign affairs? What should we take out of that? Should we be worried about it?
Well, the first thing to say is I'm delighted to be here. I'm delighted that I don't have to chair the event for once. And in particular, I'm delighted that James is chairing it, because James is really one of our leading experts in this country on the alliance, one of our leading international historians. We're very proud to have him associated with the Institute as a non-resident fellow. We were proud to publish his Lowy Institute paper last year, Fighting with America, which gives another take on the alliance in history, and I'd recommend it to you all. So thank you, James, for agreeing to chair it. I don't know whether to cry or to crow about the fact that it's the first article about Australia in 40 years. It's not the first article by an Australian in 40 years. There have been some other Australians who've written on other topics, but it's the first one about Australia in 40 years. I don't know whether to cry, because it shows that despite all the work of the Lowy Institute and all the views of those of us and the views of many of us that Australia is a significant country that matters in the world, we haven't risen to the level of, as you say, the Foreign Affairs contents page, or to crow and to Skype because the Institute has broken the drought. I guess it points to the fact that we were not there for a long time points to the fact that we didn't cause enough trouble, I guess, to the world and to the Americans, and we weren't in significant enough trouble ourselves to warrant a mention. I think that's part of it. The bad news is that we're not taken as seriously as an influence and an influencer as we like to think about ourselves sometimes. So it's a useful sort of corrective to some of the triumphalism about punching above our weight that sometimes exists. What has changed? I think there's obviously something about the Trump-Turnbull relationship. The fact that it was that call was, in a sense, the first hurdle that Mr. Trump failed to clear, because that phone call was only in a couple of days. I think it was the day after he was inaugurated, something like that. And it was the first indication when it was leaked that, oh my God, he can't even have a civil conversation with the Australians, of all things. So there's something peculiar to us. But the second point is that it's not coincidental that my article is not a standalone. As you say, it's in a collection of articles called Trump and the Allies that also has articles about France, about Britain, about Mexico, about Canada, and about one or two other countries. And so the question that Trump poses to the rest of us is, as America does less, are you guys going to do more? And so, in a sense, that's really what's changed, that the rest of us who've been to some extent free-riding off the order that the United States creates, or at least contributing less perhaps to the order than we should have and could have, and have really been relying on the United States as the center, or the central pillar of that post-World War II order, as that pillar looks a bit creaky, inevitably, I should say, the scrutiny comes on the rest of us around the edges of the order to say, okay, what are you guys going to do? And one interesting point is that almost all of the articles, almost all of the authors in this section on Trump and the allies came back at the end to, well, maybe actually this country that I'm writing about is going to step up. That was one of the interesting themes that for me that came out of the edition.
I just wanted to start as well on Afghanistan. Does yesterday's speech on Afghanistan change things in your view? Is the blob, otherwise known as the Washington foreign policy elite, back? Is Elliot Abrams, writing in the issue of Foreign Affairs previous to the one you're in, is he right in that what we're seeing now is something more along the lines of a conventional Republican foreign policy? So has Trump, the outsider, become establishment Trump? What do you think?
I don't think so. I think the blob's had a good week because President Trump has done what the blob wanted him to do on Afghanistan. But you alluded to this, I think, in your introduction. There is a kind of a wave pattern in the Trump administration where the system tries to wrap itself around Donald Trump and moderate him. And, you know, he's a bit like the Incredible Hulk, isn't he? And then he breaks out. And then the system will come back and moderate him again, and he sort of he moderates his language and his behaviour, and then he breaks out again. So, for example, we've seen this in relation to Charlottesville over the last 10 days. On several occasions, Mr. Trump has sort of said the right thing about race relations in Charlottesville under pressure from his advisers, and then a couple of days later he can't hold himself in anymore, and suddenly he's saying what he really thinks about these things. And it's the same on foreign policy. I remember in April, there was a particular moment, and you'll remember it, James, where you had the coincidence of the Mar-a-Lago summit with the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, and also the missile strikes against the al-Shayrat base in response to Bashar al-Assad's use of chemical weapons. And in those two, in the way he conducted both those responses, suddenly the world heaved a bit of a sigh of relief. The blob was happy and said, actually, this is blob-approved.
He's a globalist after all.
Behaviour, yeah. He's dealing with the Chinese as you would expect a normal president to do, and he's reacting to the crossing of a red line in the way that you would expect a US president to do, firmly but proportionately. And I was even sucked in by that moment, and I wrote something where I said that, in the Fin Review, I said that President Trump is edging towards normality, but he's a long way away from coherence. And yet, he edged back away from normality. And it was only a few weeks after that that he went to Europe. He refused to even mention Article 5, which is the article about collective self-defense in the NATO treaty, which is really at the heart of all the US alliances. So anyway, I've given you a long answer to a short question, but I think that do not judge President Trump on the basis of a speech that he gives from a teleprompter. This is a lesson that I'm learning. Judge him more on what he says in terms of his off-the-cuff remarks. And I think presidents, in the end, what matters is not the chief of staff and not the national security advisor. I think what matters is the president. And so here we've had a blob-approved decision. But the truth is, as crises emerge, Donald Trump's instincts will come to the fore, and his instincts are very far away from what he announced yesterday about Afghanistan.
Well, I guess that was one of the interesting points in that speech yesterday, wasn't it, where he said that his instincts were telling him to do one thing, but obviously he's bowed to the advice of the generals. But I think your point underscores the fact that we will be waiting a long time for any kind of coherent Trump doctrine. I think that's probably a fallacy to wait for something like that. Michael, the argument that you make in the article is essentially about Trump and US retrenchment and how allies like Australia might respond. Before we get to that Australian response, what Australia might do in this era, is this all Trump's fault? Now, John Howard, on a number of recent occasions, publicly, has tended, as do many others on the conservative side of politics, to blame Obama because Obama, in their view, led an America that was in retreat. He bungled in Libya, he bungled in Syria. But the tendency on that side of the spectrum is to, of course, forget about Iraq. Now, Trump, of course, my view is that it's not all down to Trump's election. that in fact US prestige, credibility, its ability to influence has been steadily dissipating since 9/11. So are we putting too much onto Trump? You know, we forget the second inaugural of George W. Bush, where he talked about American democracy being a seed upon the wind, taking root in many nations. Well, where are the seeds now? Do we lay too much blame on Trump? Or is he accelerating trends that were already apparent?
He's such a great target, though, isn't he? I mean, it's so tempting to lay everything on his shoulders. You're right, I think, that each in their own very different ways, President Bush and President Obama have contributed to where we get to. President Bush obviously overreached. He felt that he could remake the world. He felt that he, using preemption and regime change, he could impose his will on the Middle East and on the world and divide the world into men of steel and evildoers. And the world didn't work that way. But equal, and he lost, he wasted a lot of blood and treasure and prestige, I would argue, in the Iraq War. And then we had President Obama, who rightly, I think, wanted to learn the lessons of the Bush presidency, but overlearned them and came to office with, I think, an excessive caution about what America can achieve. And the whole leading from behind meme really flowed out of that at certain critical points, Obama didn't want to throw his weight around in a way that the United States president should. So therefore, yes, you're right, it's not all Trump's fault. But equally, James, when strategists talk about, vast changes in the international system, I think those vast subterranean forces are important, but as I've just described, I think the individual mistakes and the individual decisions of presidents matter very much. And so, although, we'll come to this, I'm sure, China and the United States and what all this means for the future of Asia, although you have to look at the relative power changes, and although things are changing in Asia, the truth is that individual decisions that presidents of China and presidents of the United States make, I think, are at least as important as those vast underlying forces. Sure.
Now, a key point, we will come back to Asia shortly, a key line for mine in this article of Michael's, he makes the point that the Trump presidency may push Australia away from the United States. But you then go on to talk about how Australia needs to be more ambitious in its foreign policy at this point. And it comes back to your earlier remark about a lot of the people writing about other alliance relationships in this period are saying that, yes, we do actually have to stand up more. There is a point to this transactional approach. So can you talk about where you think that might happen, that is the Trump presidency pushing Australia away, but also, I guess, how resilient is this alliance to these kinds of Trumpian headwinds?
Well, there's a few. I think there's a few elements. The first thing is to say that even before President Trump, there was a growing debate in Australia, and it's partly driven by changing power relativities. And there is certainly a constituency in the business community, among some strategists and some politicians, for Australia to redefine the alliance, to think about more independence within the alliance context. And I think President Trump, to some extent, he obviously helps with that because he's extremely unpopular. The 2017 Lowy Institute opinion poll showed that a very strong majority of Australians say that Mr. Trump makes them reflect much more negatively on the United States than otherwise they would. And there's lots of polling to that effect. So he doesn't jive well with Australians. Australians don't particularly like him, and that is driving changes in the political system. And so you are seeing a more overt debate about the alliance than I can remember in my adult life. On the other hand, in terms of the underlying system, as I mentioned, I think I don't think anything is inevitable in global politics. Everything is contingent. Everything depends on strategic decisions made in China and strategic decisions made in the United States. So I don't think there's some vast sort of clock that is changing, that is necessarily driving Australia away from the United States into the arms of China. I think there are forces there that are factors, but it's how those things are mediated by public opinion, by political and by political decisions. And when it comes to public opinion in Australia, although Mr. Trump is unpopular, what the 2017 poll shows is that people are separating the alliance from Mr. Trump. And so before the election, 45% of Australians said that if someone like Mr. Trump were elected, we should distance ourselves from the United States. Now less than 30% of Australians say that. So even though Mr. Trump has been even more awful, in a way, in his public behaviour, since that polling last year, Australians have become more moderate. And when you look at the political debate, James, although it's true that you have former prime ministers and former foreign ministers coming out saying pretty direct things, it is notable to me that actual players in the political system are much more cautious. So someone like Mr. Turnbull, I don't think we'll come back to Turnbull probably, but he's not redefining the alliance in any way. It's hard to see Shorten as a radical on the alliance if he were elected. So, in the end, I think Mr. Trump is a challenge. I think he makes life harder for those people who think, like me, who think the alliance is in our national interest. He definitely makes it harder for the sentimentalists, for the alliance groupies, because it's hard to be sentimental about someone like Donald Trump. But in the end, I think there are powerful forces at the national interest level, in public opinion, in our political system, which will limit, I think, to some extent, the effect of Mr. Trump on the alliance.
Do you think, even though you're talking about the discomfort for the sentimentalists, do you think the government has been too sentimental in cuddling up to Trump? I mean, does the concern over Trump and the shape of the US posture in Asia, has that coalesced with ongoing fears about the rise of China? Because I think it has been interesting to see the more hawkish tone that Bishop and Turnbull have enunciated on China in recent times. Bishop lecturing the Chinese on economic growth and prosperity will only come about ultimately, in the fullest sense, when you're a democracy. Turnbull at Shangri-La. Turnbull's preemptive invocation of the ANZUS Treaty a couple of weeks ago. Is there a risk that the kind of... and I think also it needs to be said, in fairness, there may be a point to the sentimentalism. It may be that here is what you do to a president like Trump: you swaddle him in history and you leave the serious business of running the alliance to the professionals in the bureaucracy and in the military establishment, and you give him a lesson about what allies can do when the existential threat appears. And I think that's precisely what happened aboard the Intrepid. So I can see both sides of the argument. Does the sentimentalism, though, risk Australia not doing the hard thinking about getting the Americans to do more, or what Asia might look like with a reduced American presence? What do you think?
The sentimentalism doesn't worry me, because I think you speak to people in the language that they understand. Mm-hmm. And this is our best chance of getting through to President Trump. So I was on board the Intrepid for that dinner, and I think it went as well as it could have. And if that's the language you need to use to communicate to someone like President Trump, you do it. I don't think Turnbull and the government could be accused of being slavish towards Trump, and I think the transcript of the call between Turnbull and Trump shows that. I mean, my own view was, I know you and I might have a difference about one line in the call, but my own view is, when you read that call, it is like, it is very clear that Turnbull is standing up for himself. He's not ceding ground. He's not wilting in front of Trump's, obvious anger. He's restating the case. He's holding the line in a way that, actually, I have to say, I thought was pretty impressive. Mm-hmm. I don't think Donald Trump encounters that. I don't think President Trump encounters that kind of pushback personally much. And I think that's probably why he was so angry about it and why he hung up after 25 minutes. So I don't think that that he was slavish on that or overly sentimental on that call. Where I would fault the government is that given the significance of President Trump, given that he's likely going to be there for 3.5 years, I think that should push Australia further in the not in the direction of leaning towards China, but certainly in the direction of diversifying our relationships as much as we can, not looking at the whole world through an alliance prism, thickening our connection with Asian democracies such as Japan and Indonesia and India and Vietnam, making sure that we're spending the kind of money that we need to on the capabilities that we need to operate in this world where whatever you think about America and Trump, there is much more uncertainty about the United States. And I haven't really seen that debate. I think it's good that on the defence budget that the Turnbull government has signed up to the 2% target by 2020-2021. I haven't seen much change in terms of our diplomatic network. I'd like to see a more muscular approach there. I'd like to see a bit more creative thinking, a bit more of a sense that, okay, the world is changing. We're not walking away from the alliance. We're not jumping into China's lap, but what else are we doing differently? What are the other relationships that we're really going to focus on? I haven't seen that. But I wouldn't say that Turnbull and the government has been slavish or temperamental. Mm-hmm. But you may have a different view on that, James, because you and I were talking, I think, about one line in the call, if I remember.
Yes. Well, it was the line at the very end where he said, "You can count on me, I'll be here for you again and again."
Yeah.
Which seemed to me to have older strains of that kind of sentimentality and
automaticity.
And I keep going back to the line that one Obama administration official told Jeffrey Goldberg in that interview with The Atlantic in late 2016, I think it was, just before Obama, just before the election, where he said that all of our allies give us headaches except for Australia. You can always count on Australia. And I think, again, you've got to see both sides to that. I mean, it is a good thing to be seen as a loyal and steadfast ally, to be trusted. And the point was made by a former Bush administration official recently here in Sydney that that because of Australia's ability to say yes pretty much all of the time, it gives Australia an extra special layer of access and influence in Washington. And the counter to that is sometimes it might mean that Australia is taken for granted. So I think it's a fine line. And I think if you go back to the period in the 60s, for example, when Harold Holt said that Australia was all the way with LBJ, now after the fog lifted, the hazy mist from that kind of era when Australia was one of the few allies to give freely to the cause in Vietnam, you have to ask, well, what did Australia get out of it in terms of closer consultation or in terms of real access to the inner circle? Now, Australia wasn't consulted over Vietnam withdrawals by either Johnson or Nixon. Nixon gave Australia no notice of his Guam Doctrine, which was recalibrating America's posture. And, of course, he gave Australia no notice of his shift on China policy, but the Americans gave nobody any notice of that one, so we can't really cry too foul over that. But I think there just is a point where we need to be careful about being taken for granted and what is the best way to assert Australian influence. But be that as it may.
I mean, just one comment on that. Yeah. I read that call again. I mean, there was one commentator, I think it was Phil Khoury, who said that the transcript read like someone trying to sober up a drunk man at the bar at the end of yeah. the night. I want to emphasise that was Phil Khoury saying that, not me.
Yeah.
I think the call did have a tone of a very difficult, truculent, a conversation with a truculent, difficult character. Sure. And yeah, so in that context, well. You know, sometimes you say what you need to say in a call like that. I don't think it's signing preemptively that we're going to participate in a conflict that you have with North Korea. I don't think, I think it's... It happened in the moment, so I wasn't so troubled by that. But I think you're right on your broader point that getting this line, falling on the right side of the line. I mean, We pride ourselves on being a reliable ally. At least I think it's good that Australia's a reliable ally. There's no point to an alliance if you're not going to seek if you don't believe in it enough to be a reliable ally, then you shouldn't bother doing it. But on the other hand, I don't believe in being an automatic ally. And for example, I was opposed to the Iraq War at the time, and in retrospect, I think that side of the argument is right. And I think we were wrong to participate in the Iraq War, partly because it was the wrong thing to do, but partly because of the great self-harm that the United States did by invading and occupying Iraq and the huge opportunity cost it paid. So I don't want you to think I'm saying Australia should provide advanced preemptive support for anything that Donald Trump might do. I don't think that. I think we do have to, on every issue, we have to look at it through the prism of our own national interests.
Mm-hmm. Two final questions before we open up to our guests for questions. Your article states you want America to play, that Australians want America to play a significant role in the world, and that they want America to take a firmer stance on what China is doing in the region, which leads me to the inevitable question about freedom of navigation operations. Now, John Howard has come out recently and changed his tune on this and is now arguing for Australia to do it, and I can only presume he means that we should be going through that contested 12 nautical mile zone. Is this something, again, going back to what you said at the beginning, where Australia needs to step up to the plate more? So do we need to follow the United States on a freedom of navigation patrol? And lastly, now the sky hasn't fallen in. The alliances of the United States have been through some turbulence in recent months, as has the Australia-US alliance, but it's still there, it's still standing. Tom Wright of Brookings Institution, who was here last night participating in an event, has said, if this is as bad as it gets, well, we'll take it, we'll suffer through it for the next 3.5 years, and then the old kind of America will come back, as it has so often before. Paul Keating, on the other hand, says, once America pawns the crown, it can't get it back. His line is, it's eschewed its globalism, and it'll be very hard for a new president to bring that back. So what's your take on those two issues?
I think on China, I don't say in the article that America should be tougher on China. I say that I think what most Australian policymakers would like is a more balanced approach on China, where the United States is tougher on China in the sense of stopping it from coercing its neighbours than the Obama administration was, but on the other hand, that is still open to cooperating with China where it is in US and Western and regional interests. And that's a very difficult balance to strike. It's not just about being tough on China. It's about calibrating those two prerogatives or those two imperatives. That's the balance that I would like to see the United States strike. And my problem is it's hard to look at this administration, which after all has no Asianists of note, and to say that's likely. In terms of phone ops, look, I think we should consider mm-hmm. conducting freedom of navigation operations, because I think if you believe in a rules-based order, then you should behave that way, and that involves taking on some risk. It depends on. I don't think we should be sort of sailing in the wash of an American warship. I think we should do it on our own terms. I think it depends on the circumstances at the time, and at the moment, pretty much nobody is doing phone ops except the United States. So I'd be much more comfortable if other countries would do it. I'd be much more comfortable doing it in partnership with other middle powers. But you know, if we believe in this stuff, then you need to act. As you need to do, not just to say. The second question was about the ability of a future president to bring it back.
That's right. Or is the toxicity in the American system, the kind of poison in the political wellsprings, so deep that? And I mean, you look at the forces that were sort of surging behind Bernie Sanders. You look at Clinton's abandonment of the TPP. You know, this is not something that's going to go away overnight. And how does another presidential candidate, or then another president, revive that globalist agenda? You know, I still think there's a dilemma there for America. You know, how does it reconcile those deepest beliefs about its role in the world, that it's in its DNA, this idea of the providential mission, with the limits on its capability to be able to play transformational diplomacy? I think that is my own view is that that is such a deep intellectual, psychological struggle for them, and one which I don't think they're really up for meeting at this stage. That's not to say we should indulge in the language of decline. The fundamentals of the American economy are good. They're still the most powerful military. You know, they've still got the global reach that no other country has got. You don't want to go down the path of decline. But in terms of the confidence about what they can achieve and what that means for their national self-image, where do they go to from here?
Well, you took some of my argument out of my mouth because I was going to give a more optimistic view. I mean, because we are so focused on the United States, we see all the negatives and we see all the evidence of decline. We sort of jump on it. Of course, for a country like China or Russia or India, they look at the United States and they see strength in many ways. I mean, they see still this much better demographics than the countries I've just mentioned. Terrific education system, an entrepreneurial economy like nowhere else, a magnet for talent. You don't see streams of people wanting to emigrate to Russia or China as you do to the United States. And as you say, still, you know, I think half the military expenditures in the world, the only country with the ability to project power globally. So I don't see things in such a dire way. I acknowledge that the forces that elected Donald Trump are real, mm-hmm. and they will be a constraint on American global action. But equally, let's see what the Trump experience does to the American worldview. Because if I'm right, if there is a period of retrenchment, if I'm right that the blob's had a good week but it's not going to have a good 4 years, let's see what that does, because that will probably create, if I'm right, more instability around the world, more problems that affect the United States, that will probably affect American growth and affect the American economy. And it might be that then there's an argument for the next president to come back and say, well, you see, we've actually had a president now who has departed from the orthodoxy, the post-war orthodoxy, and this is the result. So let's see.
We shall indeed. Thank you, Michael. And with that in mind, let's open the floor to questions.
How much difficulty is there in dealing with someone with a bipolar disorder like Trump when psychiatrists find it very difficult?
Is that an official diagnosis now? Or, I mean, there's a very... Look, I've followed that whole debate, including among the professional associations of psychiatrists and so on. I probably shouldn't venture into that area because my doctorate doesn't cover it. He is a very difficult individual. He does not process information particularly effectively. He is remarkably self-focused. I mean, the self-obsessed and needy, the extreme vanity and selfishness of the character is very difficult. So how do you deal with it? With great difficulty, I think. I think Malcolm Turnbull found that. You try to push back where you have to. I think to some extent you disengage as James alluded to, you try to disengage the substantive elements from the ceremonial elements, and you try to transact your substantive business with people around Donald Trump. You deal with other elements of the US government. One advantage we have here is that because of the design of the US system, unlike many other systems of government in the world, There are lots of competing powers in Washington, in the Congress. The agencies in many ways are much more independent than departments of government in Canberra. So that can be effective. And to some extent, you wait till the fever passes. And you do what you can while you're waiting for the fever to pass. You do what you can to buttress the system. And that's what I'd like Australia to start thinking about and to start working with other neighbours about. Okay, what, you know, when America is in the midst, in the grip of this fever, what can we do to contribute to the international order from which we've benefited? I should say, James, I hope you'll jump in on any of these questions if they appeal to you.
Yeah, look, the only thing I'd say very quickly, in addition to what Michael's already remarked about, is, one of the key points of analysis in a lot of commentary is, as I said before, lower expectations about what can be achieved with this administration, but engage the levels lower down. My understanding from some former colleagues in Canberra is that the Foreign Minister and the Minister for Defence have both said, why are we reading all these gloomy analyses from the bureaucracy about what Trump means for the international order? We're dealing with this administration and it's not that bad. Okay, which reinforces the kind of view that now we're seeing more of the adults in charge, and that Australia will get very good access at the level of the Vice President, the Secretary of State, and Secretary of Defence, as we've already seen. So that's one point. The other point is, yes, he's not a great reader and processor of information, but as Tom Wright showed in an analysis for the Lowy Institute last year, that on the question of alliances and multilateral trade, he's been very consistent for the past 30 years. I mean, these are the two things that really get under his skin. Allies who he believes are ripping America off and trade deals that are doing the same thing. So, and we know that in the campaign he was very strong on immigration. I mean, I guess that's where I would have thought perhaps Turnbull could have said, let's let officials further down the line handle this with the Americans. I won't talk about this issue in the first phone call. But equally, he needed to get Trump's attention on it, probably. He needed to get this signed off for Turnbull's own domestic political purposes. So that's all I'd add at that stage. But there is a level of consistency there in the Trump worldview on certain questions.
But it's consistency that doesn't help us.
No, that's right.
It's consistently wrong-headed views on those issues, unfortunately.
I was just saying that it seems at the current moment of time that the administration looks in a state of disarray. What do you think would happen, not just to the alliance, but generally, if we were to have another global financial crisis or unforeseen major political incident? And in that environment, do you see his use of Twitter being a significant problem? When you look at things like Kennedy's handling of the Cuban Missile Crisis, et cetera, and how delicate it can be, do you think his temperament in that environment is a particular problem?
Yes. Yes, I do. I think that if you think of when Obama came to office in the middle of the Great Recession with banks failing, I think the steadiness and the calmness and the ability to process information as it came through and make decisions and take advice, I think in addition to the decisions themselves, just the state of mind and the approach, I think, was one that gave confidence to markets and to the world. And Mr. Trump doesn't have any of that. And although I would like to think that as James sort of alludes to, that to some extent people are just pricing in the fact that he's going to tweet crazy, crazy things, I don't think we can rely on that. I mean, the statement, for example, about the fire and the fury in relation to North Korea. I don't think the President of the United States should be saying things like that. Yes, the North Koreans say that stuff because they're the hermit kingdom and they traffic in that sort of provocative language. But I don't think the President of the United States should be doing that because you don't know how the other guy is going to read it and you don't know how he's going to interpret it. So yes, I think his temperament is a major concern. It's a major concern because we know that the constraints on the ability of the president to act in foreign policy are much lighter than the constraints that exist on him or her in domestic policy. So I worry about tweets, I worry about statements, but I don't just worry about that. I worry about actual things that he might do if the question of prestige and face and his personal dignity come into play. I think that's, I referred earlier about to his vanity and his egotism. What if one of these guys really gets under his skin and makes it personal in relation to Mr. Trump? Would any of us have confidence that, whereas someone like Obama, who was not perfect, but who had a great governing temperament, would just say, well, whatever, let them exhaust themselves. They want to throw sticks and stones at me. I don't worry about it. Does any of us have the confidence that Donald Trump would have the personal maturity to do that? I do not have confidence about that.
My question's in relation to the US economy. There's some comments about the strength of it at the moment, but I guess with everything that's been going on in the media since Trump came in, the big question around debt levels in the US economy and the ability for the US to be, I guess, to continue on as the world's policeman, if that's what they choose. I just wanted to get some comments around that.
Should we take the question from the gentleman next door and answer both of them?
Yeah, mine has to do the relationship between domestic politics and Trump. I mean, it was interesting you made the comment that Trump helps with the questioning of the US alliance. And I think just today, the Labor Party, the defence, you know, came out and openly questioned the alliance and whether we should so strongly continue the way that we have over the last 50, 60 years. I just thought it was interesting that they've actually, the opposition has actually come out and sort of made emboldened statements I haven't heard before. Maybe they have. And it just seems that if in the next election the opposition were to win power, what's your reading on that and the relationship with the US?
Well, I'll just take the Labor Party angle first. I should preface this by saying I haven't heard the statements. I'd be very surprised if they were questioning the value of the alliance, although I know you're paraphrasing it. That's fine. Labor will be very mindful, I think, of the last time that a Labor leader was seen to be suspect on the alliance and weak on national security. Even though, in my view, Mark Latham had a perfectly reasonable position to bring the Australian troops home by Christmas at the end of 2004, nevertheless, he was made to pay a very heavy political price for that decision. And he had John Howard on the run earlier that year. And from the moment he made that call, it was then, as you will recall, it was then painted as cutting and running on Iraq and on the US alliance. And I think Labor is still carrying the scars of that experience. And in some ways, if you look at Labor statements since that time, at times they've tried to be more pro-American than some of the Conservatives. Sorry, did you have a follow-up? Or yeah. Yeah, sure.
We now have an entirely new situation that impacts on the way Australians view America and therefore the nature of that alliance.
All I've heard is Penny Wong give a completely reasonable statement where she said we should be looking to express more self-reliance both within and without the alliance. And I think that is, you know, and that we need to look, this might be, I think she used an expression, not some, was it a turning point?
Change point.
A change point. That's right. That is perfectly reasonable, I think, for the Labor Party to have that position. But I would be very surprised if they opened themselves up on that flank, if there was too much daylight between themselves and the government on this relationship, because they must know surely that all the old spectres, not only from Latham, but from the Cold War, will be brought up and used against them, as John Howard did. I take your point. Trump is different. But public support for the alliance, as Lowy Institute polling shows, is still very strong. Dislike Trump, still want to keep the alliance. So I think those factors will need to be taken into account.
I think I agree with that. I'd say that first of all, the interests of the opposition are not directed towards really opening up daylight on the alliance, because I think it's about 3/4 of Australians still think the alliance is very important. As I said, less than 3 out of 10 Australians want us to distance ourselves now that Mr. Trump has been elected. That's polling that took place after Mr. Trump was elected. So the public opinion is not pushing them in that direction. And secondly, if you look at the personal preferences of Mr. Shorten and Senator Wong, I don't think that's really pushing them in that direction either. I would see Mr. Shorten, probably, he would see himself, I think, as a foreign policy prime minister, probably in the tradition of someone like Hawke, someone who's broadly pro-American. He's on the pro-Israel side of the debate within the Labor Party, as Hawke was. Someone very centrist. It's hard to see him as a radical. He has said some things about Mr. Trump during the last campaign. But still, I mean, just looking at him and squinting your eyes, he doesn't look like an alliance radical. I think Penny Wong has so far has shown herself to be a very thoughtful person on the alliance. The speech about referring to the alliance as a change point was the line that people picked up out of it, but it by no means did it call for stepping away from the alliance. And the very good speech that she gave here was very much, I think, in the tradition of liberal internationalism that exists within the Labor Party, but that exists side by side with a pro-alliance theme. So, look, I don't see it myself in terms of the opposition. In terms of the economy, I'm definitely not an economist, as my colleagues know. I think that the bump that the US economy got immediately after the Trump election was an example of what a previous head of the Fed described as irrational exuberance that could not possibly be justified on the grounds of Mr. Trump's policies or his personality. I think it was to some extent a harking back to the golden days of Reagan and thinking maybe this is what we're in for. But I think Mr. Trump is a very different kind of president from Mr. Reagan. So far, he has achieved no significant legislative victories. He said that healthcare, that was going to be a big part of improving the prospects of the American economy, but the Republicans couldn't get healthcare through, even though they've got majorities in both houses. None of the things he's tried to do in terms of executive orders have stuck. They're all caught up in the courts. I think the markets were excited about the possible infrastructure spend because that means a lot of money flowing through the economy. But I think it's hard to see that getting through the deficit hawks in Congress. So far, Mr. Trump is not succeeding as a domestic policy president. Whether you agree with his ideas or not, he's not putting his ideas into action. He's not getting legislation through. He's not issuing executive orders that are taking effect. And so, therefore, his ability to positively affect the economy in anything except a sort of an emotional sense, I think, is limited.
And just to add to that, too, he's obviously surely aware that part of the forces that drove him to power was his ability to be able to express the fatigue amongst middle America at the country's foreign policy adventurism and the expense not only of blood but a great deal of treasure in terms of American adventurism in the Middle East. And as Michael said, he's got no legislative achievements to show. What does this mean for his great infrastructure program, for example? What does it mean for his promise to bring back manufacturing and to bring back all those jobs? The expectations that he raised on the economic level were huge. Now, they were of a very different order to the expectations that Obama unleashed on his election in 2008, which were of a cultural and social kind. But these are huge, and he will be held to account. Now, there's no doubt, I think, at the ballot box come the midterm elections next year.
So my question is actually to Hervé Lamy at the Lowy Institute. I'm interested in hearing what you think of the departure of Steve Bannon, because in the absence of this chief court intellectual of Donald Trump, his critics, it looks to me, are much more fixating much more again on his temperament rather than Trump's ideas. And is that not a danger? Because even if Trump weren't as temperamentally flawed as he is, the fact is he reflects a set of ideas and a set of, he reflects the structural disaffection of voters, which may be much more dangerous than simply his temperament.
Do you believe, Michael, that the people who Trump has surrounded himself with recently will be easier for Australia to handle than the people who were there at the beginning of his administration?
Well, they're good. They're both good questions because they're really on the same topic, and that is the personnel. I think, look, it can't be bad news that Steve Bannon is no longer skulking around the West Wing. I mean, that can't be bad news for anybody who believes in the strength of the West, for anybody who rejects some of the ugly side of American life that we saw last week in Charlottesville. I think it's an unalloyed good thing that Steve Bannon is no longer a close advisor to the President of the United States. I also think that the generals are all highly credentialed people. I mean, they are, to my mind, highly deserving people. General McMaster is a very thoughtful general officer and a strategist, and someone who wrote a book about speaking truth to power in relation to Vietnam. General Kelly is a very impressive person. I'd urge all of you to read something I tweeted a couple of days ago, a eulogy that he gave to a couple of Marines that he gave just a few days after his own son was killed in the line of duty. He's a very impressive individual, and the same for General Mattis, whom I've described as the hope of the side. I'm sometimes asked, are you worried about the prevalence of generals in the White House? And I say, well, first of all, I think those guys are actually pretty good. And secondly, beggars can't be choosers. They're better than the alternative. So yes, I think it's good that he's left. And yes, I think that it's good that those guys are there. But in the end, I look at number one. Number one was elected. Donald Trump was elected. Steve Bannon wasn't elected. And General Kelly wasn't elected. Donald Trump was elected. And he's the president we have to deal with. That's the temperament we have to cope with. Those are the ideas on alliances. He's had very fixed ideas, not just on alliances and on trade, but on democracies, on autocrats. On his views on the world are pretty fixed. And so I try not to get too high when the Steve Bannons of this world leave, not to get too low when the Steve Millers of this world join. I try not to get too high when Mr. Trump gives a speech on the teleprompter and not to get too low when he gives an off-the-cuff remark or a dreadful tweet, because you can draw a straight line through an average line through the middle of it, and that is Mr. Trump himself. That's whom we have to deal with, and that's scary enough.
Just very quickly, yeah, that's a good question, and I do think economic nationalism, whilst its arch representative has marched out onto Pennsylvania Avenue and is gone, that those forces of economic nationalism that he was such an ardent proponent of are still there. I mean, there's still lots of Bannon lieutenants around the White House, people like Peter Navarro, for example, who, as many of you know, wrote a book called Death by China. Some of the more controversial steps as part of this Bannon vision of a trade war with China have not come to pass. You know, Trump didn't label them, as you know, a currency manipulator. He didn't slap the 45% tariff on Chinese imports. He has announced an inquiry or an investigation by the US Trade Representative into intellectual property theft, but he's only authorised the US Trade Representative to see whether an investigation should be held. Now, he probably will find, without a doubt, that China's been doing naughty things in that regard, but what do you do then? Because he must surely know that the Chinese will retaliate. So I think again, those economic nationalist forces are a very deep current of what brought number one to power. So let's see how it plays out.
James, just before we finish, can I say one thing? Mm-hmm. I want to publicly acknowledge my research associate, Alastair Davis, who was really a great assistance in writing this article. I'm the tip of the spear. I've got a fantastic team at the Lowy Institute, but it's having people like Alastair and Ali and others to help me that allows me to free up some time to write, that to help me get all the material in front of me that I need to write, and that add in very material and real ways. So I think Alistair is not here because he's working on, possibly because he's working on speech notes for something I'm doing tomorrow. But even in his absence, you'll tell him, great. In his absence, I want to thank him and the team for really helping me to write this article, which I'm very pleased to see out. And thank you, James.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, everybody, for coming.